Good day, this is Greg, and I'll be reading the Vermilion County News for Tuesday, March 17th, 2026. From the commercial news today on the front page, we have a story by Chad Dare titled Giving Back, Tournament Teams Make an Impact in Danville Community. Danville. This Saturday night at the Mary Miller Center, one team is going to cut down the nets and enjoy one of the greatest moments as a team with a national championship. And while that experience is the ultimate on-court reward, there are other adventures away from basketball that are just as satisfying. On Sunday afternoon, two of the 20 teams in this week's NJCAA Division II National Tournament made appearances at Liberty Village of Danville, meeting the residents at both Liberty Estates and Hawthorne Inn. Greeted with cookies and inquisitive residents, the Pima County College Aztecs and the host, Danville Area Community College Jaguars, gained a great deal of support. "It's just a way to give back to the community," said DACC sophomore guard Jordan Dixon. "A lot of people in this community are very important to our success this season. This is our way of giving back a little bit of that support to our community." Dixon added, "I've seen a bunch of these people at our games this season. It means a lot to us. Making it to the national tournament, and it shows the kind of support we've gotten from our community." Pima sophomore forward Mason Pippett spent a great deal of time with Ted Zwemmer and Don Elliott. Both Zwemmer and Elliott are planning to attend games at the tournament, especially the Pima games. "Everyone here in Danville does a whole lot for us to play in this tournament," Pippett said. "It feels good to be able to give back and just interact with people here at Liberty Estates. I had some really cool conversations and met some cool people. It's a special opportunity to do something like this." Getting out into the community is nothing new for either Pima or DACC. "We do these types of things through the season," DACC coach Dewan Guard said. "We go to schools. We go to youth basketball events. We visit nursing homes. And we help out at food pantries. But why do it just the hours before the biggest tournament of the season? Now is a time for us to be together more," Gord said. "We approach our first game that togetherness is what we need to advance to the next round." And both Dixon and Pippett acknowledged that their time at Liberty Village proved that there is more than basketball in life. "Honestly, I think coming here helps," Pippett said. "Sometimes when you focus on something like winning a national title too much, it can become overbearing. Just having this time to take your mind off of that for just a little bit can help you stay locked in and doing what you need to do." Eleanor Murphy, who has been a resident at Liberty Estates for the last 2 years, admits, "It's great to meet the kids." Murphy spent several minutes talking with DACC sophomore and former Oakwood standout Alec Harrison, who was more than a foot taller than Murphy. "These boys are just so friendly and outgoing," she said, telling us about their lives and how they got to their schools. "It was a nice afternoon." And Murphy plans on following both DACC and Pima. "I have my radio, and I will be listening to the games," she said. Pima will play Davidson Davie at 9 a.m. Tuesday, while DACC takes on Mid-Michigan at 6 p.m. on Tuesday. Our next story is titled, District 118 Seeks Public Input on Handbook. And this is by Christy Jankowski. Danville. District 118 is changing its handbook, and they are looking for the community for input. According to administration, Changes to discipline based on current laws and the needs of students will be the focus of ownership and education meetings. An in-person meeting was held on March 5th at Northeast Elementary Magnet School, but there are still two online meetings set for 4 to 4:30 p.m. on Thursday, March 26th, and Thursday, April 9th. The meetings will be a good opportunity for parents and guardians to ask questions, says Blake Bodine, the assistant principal at Southview Upper Elementary School. We continuously evaluate and strengthen procedures to ensure they reflect current laws, best practices, and the needs of our students, Bodine said. There is nothing specific attendees need to bring. We simply advise attendees to review the handbook in advance and come prepared with any questions or suggestions. There will be discussions on how technology is changing discipline procedures throughout the district, according to Bodine. Last year, we added artificial intelligence, or AI, guidance and updated cell phone expectations to reflect modern learning environments, he said. When asked about prior threats against the district, he said student safety is always a priority. There have been threats at Danville High School during the 2025-26 school year. He went on to add about those types of situations. When situations involving threats arise, the district follows established safety and threat assessment protocols led at the district level to ensure appropriate investigation and response. During the meeting, interventions that will be discussed, he said, will be behavioral interventions, restorative practices, and tiered interventions within our multi-tiered system of supports framework. Our approach emphasizes accountability while also helping students learn and make better decisions moving forward. Our final story from the front page today is titled, What to Expect in the State Primary. And this is by Robert Yoon from the Associated Press. Multiple political storylines will converge in Illinois on Tuesday, when the state holds primaries shaped by attempted comebacks, the retirement of longtime incumbents, and the looming 2028 presidential campaign. Voters will choose nominees for a full slate of offices, including governor, U.S. Senate, U.S. House, the state legislature, and local offices. Topping the ballot is the race to succeed Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, who is retiring after 5 terms. Among the Democrats running are U.S. Representatives Robin Kelly and Raja Krishnamoorthy and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who has Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's endorsement. The Republican fields include former state Republican Chair Don Tracy and attorney Jeannie Evans. Krishnamoorthy dwarfed both fields in fundraising at the end of February, with about $6.6 million in the bank after transferring more than $19 million from his U.S. House campaign account. Tracy was the top fundraiser among Republicans, with about $1.8 million in the bank. Unlike the state's other U.S. Senate seat, which recently ended a streak of 5 consecutive occupants who served for 1 term or less, Durbin's seat has had much less turnover. Durbin took office in 1997 and is only the second person to hold the seat in more than 40 years. In the race for governor, Pritzker is unopposed in his bid for renomination. President Donald Trump's return to office in 2025 has heightened Pritzker's national profile, and the 2-term incumbent governor is now among a handful of Democrats dominating speculation about the 2028 Democratic presidential race. In the Republican primary, four candidates look to thwart Pritzker's re-election bid in November, including former state senator Darren Bailey, who lost to Pritzker in the 2022 governor's race. The state's largest counties tend to play a critical role in both Democratic and Republican primaries, with Chicago's Cook County by far the largest prize. In the Senate race, 8 of the 10 Democrats running are from Chicago or its nearby suburbs in Cook County, potentially diluting any hometown advantage in the region. The winners of statewide Democratic primaries typically have an advantage heading into November, considering Democrats have won recent key statewide general elections with more than 55% of the vote. In the U.S. House primaries, Kelly and Krishnamoorthy's Senate bids and the retirements of longtime Democratic U.S. Representatives Danny Davis and Jan Schakowsky have attracted crowded fields of candidates running to replace them. Among the hopefuls are two former Democratic members mounting political comebacks. In the 2nd Congressional District, Jesse Jackson Jr. is running to replace Kelly, who replaced Jackson in 2013 following his conviction in a campaign fraud case. He is the son of civil rights leader the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who died February 17th. His primary opponents include Cook County Commissioner Donna Miller and State Senators Robert Peters and Willie Preston. In the 8th Congressional District Democratic primary, former U.S. Representative Melissa Bean is running to replace Krishnamoorthy in a field that includes Neil Cote, Junaid Ahmed, and Dan Tully. Durbin's pick in the race is his former aide, Yasmin Bankole. The Associated Press does not make projections and will declare a winner only when it's determined there is no scenario that would allow a trailing candidate to close the gap. If a race has not been called, the AP will continue to cover any newsworthy developments, such as candidate concessions or declarations of victory. In doing so, the AP will make clear that it has not yet declared a winner and explain why. Illinois does not have an automatic recount law. Candidates who receive at least 95% of the first-place candidate's vote may request and pay for a limited recount, but the recount results are non-binding and will not change the outcome of the election. A court may also order a recount as part of an election contest case. The AP may declare a winner in a race that is subject to a recount if it can determine the lead is too large for a recount or legal challenge to change the outcome. Here are some of the key facts about the election and data points the AP decision team will monitor as the votes are tallied. When do polls close? Polls close at 7 p.m. What's on the ballot? The AP will provide vote results and declare winners in contested primaries for U.S. Senate, U.S. House, Governor, Secretary of State, Comptroller, State Senate, and State House, as well as some local races in Cook, DuPage, Kane, and Will counties. Some additional statewide offices, such as State Attorney General and Treasurer, will also be on the ballot, but the races are uncontested, aside from the write-in option. Who gets to vote? Any eligible voter may participate in any party's primary. Illinois allows voters to register on Election Day. Turnout, advance votes. As of Friday, there were about 8,976,000 registered voters in Illinois. The state does not register voters by party. About 857,000 votes, were cast in the 2022 Democratic U.S. Senate primary and about 715,000 in the Republican primary. Roughly 33% of the total vote was cast before primary day. More than 535,000 ballots had already been cast in the primary as of Friday. Early and absentee votes. While a handful of Illinois counties may release early and absentee vote results at the start of the night, the bulk of counties merge them with Election Day results throughout the night or release them toward the end of the tabulation process. As of Tuesday, there will be 231 days until the 2026 midterm elections. That's the end of the front page stories today, and as we have no obituaries, we're going to turn to the opinion page for an editorial titled Bears Move Political Football for Indiana-Illinois. The Chicago Bears aren't looking for trouble. Like in 1985, they just want to do the Super Bowl shuffle. Except this time, the shuffling could be between Soldier Field in Chicago and a former dumping ground 20 miles away in Hammond, Indiana. The possible relocation of the NFL franchise, which longs for a new, larger stadium, begs football comparisons as the Indiana General Assembly attempts an end run around Illinois' legislature to score an upset. But it's certainly a Hail Mary effort. Indiana's Republican leaders can't seem to get enough of Illinois. They treat the land of Lincoln like a political football. Last year, Indiana Speaker of the House, Todd Houston, pushed for a study to evaluate the feasibility of Indiana absorbing up to 33 mostly rural and very conservative Illinois counties. But such a move would require approval from both states and Congress. The concept all but died after the first and only meeting in October, so far, of the Indiana-Illinois Boundary Adjustment Commission. This past session, Senate Pro Tem Rod Bray authored Senate Bill 27, now signed into law, to establish a stadium authority to build a facility in Da Region. Houston was also involved making a key pitch to the House Ways and Means Committee. Last season's 11-6 Bears had previously announced that Arlington Heights in Cook County was the only location that met the requirements for a world-class NFL stadium. As Kevin Warren, president and CEO of the Chicago Bears, said to fans, "The Bears have called Chicago home for more than a century. One certainly is that our commitment to this city will not change. We will continue to provide unwavering support to the community. We need to secure a world-class venue for our passionate fan base and honor the energy you bring every week. The Chicago Bears are a founding franchise, playing in the oldest and smallest stadium in the NFL. The Bears have pledged $2 billion towards a new stadium. If built in Indiana, bonds would be issued, and a new admissions tax would be created, as would a special professional sports development area where taxes would be collected to help fund the project. The Illinois legislature is pondering a bill that would freeze property taxes on a new stadium. We should all wonder if the Bears are playing Indiana's legislature to get a better deal in Illinois. Would the Bears really move to Hammond, referred to on its city flag as the land of peace pipe along the Calumet River? What would we call the Bears if they moved there? Simply Da Region Bears? How about Monsters of the Calumet? Or perhaps, as one pundit has offered, the Hammond Eggs? Hammond's mayor has said the area around the stadium, now known as Wolf Lake, which is split in two by the Indiana Toll Road, would be called Bearsville. Would the Indianapolis Colts replace the Green Bay Packers as the Bears' chief rival? Could the rivalry culminate in an I-65 Super Bowl? Have we already forgotten that the Bears lost to the Colts in the Super Bowl after the 2006 season? Yes, and the shift could occur, but the Bears aren't looking for trouble. They just want to do the Indiana General Assembly hustle. And this was from the Herald Bulletin in Anderson, Indiana. Next up is a column by George Will, titled, America Needs Immigrants as Much as They Need Liberty's Blessings. Two dissimilar government agencies have inadvertently combined to clarify the immigration debate. Stomach-turning excesses by Immigration and Customs Enforcement have turned many Americans' abstract political preference into something uncomfortably concrete. And the Census Bureau has demonstrated that the nation needs immigrants as much as they need the blessings of American liberty. Given a clear binary choice for or against deporting immigrants who are here illegally, most Americans favor deportation. However, one Sunday, a moderately pro-deportation America goes, as usual, for brunch at the neighborhood diner. Jose, who has put waffles in front of this American for 20 years and who regularly exchanges pleasantries with him about their families, is gone. He has been deported for America's improvement. Suddenly, the immigration issue has a face and complexity. President Joe Biden's choice not to enforce immigration laws poisoned the immigration debate and led the government behavior today that is deepening distrust of government. The influx during Biden's 4 years, 8.3 million, more than in the preceding 12 years, torrential and dispersed, has clouded the picture. This, however, seems true. The foreign-born portion of the U.S. population, 15.8%, is higher than at any time since at least 1850. But as of 2023, only 27% were not authorized to be here. More than half of all immigrants, 52%, have become U.S. citizens. Prior to the Biden inundation, most undocumented immigrants had arrived before 2010. 43%, as of 2020, had been here at least 20 years. About one-third were homeowners, and their 5 million children born here were citizens. Talk of sending them home is nonsensical. They are home, for which give thanks. The Census Bureau reports that between July of 2024 and July of 2025, the U.S. population grew by just 0.5%, 1.4 million less than in the previous 12 months, primarily because of less immigration. According to the Pew Research Center, during the first 6 months of this administration, the foreign-born population shrank by more than a million, the first decline since the 1960s. According to the Migration Policy Institute, between 2022 and 2023, for the first time since relevant census data began being collected in 1850, immigration accounted for the entire U.S. population growth. As the U.S. population ages, those leaving the workforce enter Social Security and Medicare. The nation's birth rate is below the replacement rate, so immigration must replenish the workforce whose tax contributions fund the entitlements. Immigrants are 23.6% of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, workers. Nurses, 15.9% foreign-born, and health aides, 28.4% foreign-born, are crucial to an aging America. A recent Cato Institute report titled Immigrants' Recent Effects on Government Budgets 1994 through 2023 says immigrants generated more in taxes than they received in benefits from all levels of government. They created a cumulative fiscal surplus of $14.5 trillion in real 2024 U.S. dollars, including $3.9 trillion in savings on interest that did not need to be paid on debt that was not added. Immigrants were, on average, more than 12% more likely to be employed than the U.S.-born population. Per Cato, in 1994, the immigrant share of government expenditures was 18% below their share of the population. In 2023, it was 25% below. In 2023, immigrants constituted almost 18% of the civilian labor force, and more than a third of them were in management, professional, and related occupations, almost double the 21% in service occupations, such as hospitality. In 2023, immigrant median household income of $78,700 was slightly above that of U.S.-born households at $77,600. The Cato data comes from static, not dynamic, accounting. It does not, for example, gauge immigration's dynamism injection. Immigration, risk-taking for improved opportunity, is an entrepreneurial act. Unsurprisingly, immigrants' workforce participation rate of 66.5% is higher than that of U.S.-born population at 61.7%. And immigrants' portions of U.S. patents and startups exceeds immigrants' portion of the population. As Cato notes, many illegal immigrants who are employed under borrowed or stolen identities have taxes withheld by employers, but are ineligible for many government benefits, and they are less likely than others to file returns in order to claim refunds. This is another reason why, Cato says, immigrants have created an enormous fiscal surplus for the U.S. government. The $14.5 trillion in savings from immigrants is the equivalent of 33% of the total inflation-adjusted combined deficits from 1994 to 2023 without immigrants. That fellow having brunch at the diner will still get his waffles, but he will miss Jose and millions like him in more ways than he can easily imagine. And turning to the community briefs section now, we have VFW holds spaghetti dinner. The VFW Post 2395 Auxiliary will hold a spaghetti dinner from 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern on Friday, March 20th, at the Post located at 1212 Liberty Street in Covington, Indiana. The menu will include spaghetti, salad, breadsticks, dessert, and drink. Cost is $12 for the public and $10 for veterans. And teaching older adults about staying safe online, video chatting, and choosing a new computer are just classes offered during a series of free classes at Chris Healthy Aging, located at 309 North Franklin Street in Danville. The classes will run from 1 until 2 p.m. on Fridays until May 1st. Paced for beginners, classes cover a wide range of topics. The ARP Senior Plant Division provides curriculum for each class. Attendees may take as many classes as they wish, or choose only classes that fit their needs. No registration is needed. The next session, Healthcare and Tech at a Glance, will be on Friday, March 20th. For information, go to their website, chrishealthyaging.org, or you can call the office at 217-443-2999. And that takes us to the end of our time for this Tuesday, March 17th, 2026. Again, my name is Greg, and as always, it's been a pleasure to read for you, and I hope that you have a splendid day. Take care.